So our theme this month, seeing ourselves in others, implies that we can see ourselves clearly. Is this true? Well, let's start with a little bit of Rumi on that subject. You suppose you are the trouble, but you are the cure. You suppose that you are the lock on the door, but you are the key that opens it. It's too bad you want to be someone else. You don't see your own face, your own beauty. Yet, no face is more beautiful than yours. So, Rumi's talking about our case of mistaken identity. We have all sorts of wrong ideas and beliefs about ourselves because we don't see our own face. It's too bad we want to be somebody else, he says. That somebody else is a separate self created by thought. So if we can't see and know ourselves clearly, how can we possibly understand who or what others might be? You and I go right to the heart of our personal world. We mostly believe ourselves to be persons, and our lives are built up around that. But though these descriptions of reality can be useful in navigating the world, they're not really true. Reality is much closer to what we are than we realize. But something in us runs away from that without seeing. In fact, the personal is like a hedge or a veil we put over reality in an attempt to stay safe and to keep life at bay. We fear the intensity of being in the midst of life without a crutch or an excuse. It may feel like being naked in public. Does that sound appealing? This is what Rumi says when he says, you don't see your own face, your own beauty. So I'd like to explore this veil of me and you from a non-dual perspective. Several weeks ago, I was in the deli line at Super One, and in front of me, the clerk was handing a chocolate ice cream cone to a small boy seated in the shopping cart. He was about 4 years old, and he was the picture of childhood sweetness, glowing with a relaxed, innocent face. The clerk said to him, "Now hang on to this one." So we know what happened to the first cone. But the boy showed no hint of embarrassment or chagrin at having lost the first cone. His young father looked on with loving attention, and I was captivated as I watched the boy, unselfconscious and content as he enjoyed his ice cream. All I could do was smile. I reflected deeply on this experience. It was an unexpected encounter with palpable beauty. It was a display of the openness and kindness of human beings and of love moving through life and the pristine innocence that we are all born with before the accumulating impressions that seem to cover it. This event affected me so much because in that moment I recognized that I essentially was that innocence, and so is everybody else. The poet William Wordsworth wrote of the astonishing beauty of childhood innocence. He said, "Not in entire forgetfulness, and not in utter nakedness, But trailing clouds of glory do we come from God who is our hope. Anyone who has held a young child can attest to that. But then later, as life experience begins to accumulate, darken and close in, Wordsworth writes, "Shades of the prison house begin to close upon the growing boy." That's in the same poem. The shades of the prison house is a veil of our own making. Without realizing it, the traumas, unquestioned assumptions, attachments, and the demands we place on life accumulate, separating me from you. This veil happens over such a long time, fueled by our intense desire to please, to conform, to find some assurance that we're okay, that we do not see it. We look through the veil and it colors our life in ways we may only slightly be aware of. But Spirit calls us out from behind that veil. The veil may temporarily lift at times when reality is either so awful or so awesome that our usual filters drop away. When we become so stifled and miserable behind the veil that we're suffocating, sometimes we can have a breakthrough spiritual emergency. But it can happen with awe, too. For instance, at the 4th of July fireworks display, all of a sudden, recognition of the limitless beauty and ecstasy of being alive, not as a person, but as life itself, floods in. This is true of little things, too. If we obtain something we've been wanting and feel that sense of satisfaction, we're just temporarily feeling the ever-present completeness and fulfillment of our real self. When we feel no sense of lack, we're just remembering the innate happiness of our real self in being. So even though we seem to be living the life of a person with temporary hints of a larger life beyond, we actually are that larger life, but living it from behind a veil that from time to time is pierced by the overwhelming beauty and awe of our real life in wholeness. So what keeps that veil between us in place? I would suggest that the most succinct word for it is trauma. Trauma happens when experience seems too coarse, harsh, or devastating for our real innocent self. Our thinking creates someone who can retreat, dissociate, or become numb, locked away behind experience. Most people carry at least some intense but long forgotten impressions from the past. And this hidden pain may show up as a mild neurosis or as a strong reaction to certain circumstances. Either are the signs of harboring incomplete experience. Not only this, but Richard Rudd, the spiritual teacher who created the Gene Keys, teaches that we carry the trauma of our species right in the DNA of our being. If we can imagine the difficulties of countless generations of human beings in war, famine, pestilence, epidemics, and the suffering that goes with that. These are the collective veils of race, gender, ethnicity, nationality, that are all imaginary differences in 2026 being acted out in all manner of ways. Even the crisis of climate change, income inequality, breakdown of institutions and norms could all be seen as larger consequences of that veil that keeps us from seeing ourselves in our neighbor and taking responsibility for that. So if the thrust of events pressing on us to accept that reality is one, and that only one force moves and acts on everything and everyone to evolve and become more conscious, then it's inevitable that unity will be the outcome, even though it looks very messy. Our real self, what the Sufis call the friend, is at work purifying each one of us. And this cleansing in the hands of the one is beautifully described in this poem by Rumi. It's probably my favorite of all time, called The Leather Tanner. A hide is soaked in tanning liquor and becomes leather. If the tanner did not rub in the acid, the hide would get foul-smelling and rotten. The soul is a newly skinned hide, bloody and gross. Work on it with manual discipline and the bitter tanning acid of grief, and you'll become lovely and very strong. If you can't do this work yourself, don't worry. You don't even have to make a decision one way or another. The friend, who knows a lot more than you do, will bring difficulties and grief and sickness as medicine, as happiness, as the essence of the moment when you're beaten, when you hear checkmate and can say with Halaja's voice, "I trust you to kill me." Rumi is saying that reality keeps creating situations that purify, drawing us back into our real self, in the everything and the nothing. We know we're checkmated on this when we finally see that all of our efforts to avoid our real nature by following immature impulses or pretending to be a separate self are completely futile. What the leather tanner describes is the muddled life of human beings, believing that their egos actually have agency. Whether we realize it or not, something vast and overriding is actually in charge of our lives. By acceptance, turning the light of compassion on ourselves and others, and submitting to the one's purification, we become strong and very beautiful. And if we ask, how can I free myself from this? You don't have to go looking for your limitations. The friend will present them. Take your stand as neutral, compassionate awareness and feel into your real self, which is coming through. Exactly what Ernest Holmes was saying there in that piece you gave, Larry. Someone once said, every human being is a work of art made from the best available materials. That would be each of us. Can we appreciate that, no matter how much we may dislike what we see in another? Can we understand this even in the face of moral corruption and cruelty? We could refer to this as the human condition, so full of potential and promise, so capable of great beauty, creativity, and achievement for the good of the whole, while also being rife with fear, resistance, unconsciousness, and moral corruption. And if we can see these elements in ourselves, we begin to understand everyone else. We are all the same, only some perhaps a little more conscious than others. So when we look at another, we might start by simply seeing the human condition in them, the intelligence that fashions each of us is brilliant at taking inspiration, pain, beauty, ugliness, hardship, privilege, or poverty, and weaving it into a work of art worthy of the universe. At the same time, when I look at another, he or she is exactly like me, a mysterious expression of being, mostly unaware of his or her pain that creates separation, difficulties, unhappiness, carried along silently in a background of quiet desperation. When the great Hindu sage Ramana Maharshi was asked, "How should we treat others?" he replied, "There are no others." This insight comes from the deepest heart of reality. If everywhere we look, there is only the face of the one, then if we see difference, pain, and separation, it's only a temporarily veiled expression of the limitless source. So this reflection, all of this, invites us to look within. Who would you be without the demands you make on life and the assumptions, fears, and attachments that keep you behind a veil? Are you willing to submit to the leather tanner, the friend who knows a lot more than you do, and heartfully accept the purification that one brings our way? Are you brave enough to be so open that life becomes a mirror in which you see more and more of yourself, like when I saw myself and everyone else as an innocent angel eating an ice cream cone? Can we let these insights resonate through us like an earthquake? Rumi understood this process. He says what we truly are, but that we back away from it. We are the night ocean filled with glints of light. We are the space between the fish and the moon while we sit here together. Sometimes afraid of reunion, sometimes of separation, you and I, so fond of the notion of a you and I, should live as though we'd never heard these pronouns. Two strong impulses, one to drink long and deep, the other not to sober up too soon. So Ramana and Rumi say the same thing. We cling to being human, but that carries with it a veil of pain, and we call that pain me and you. But you and I are eternally pressed by the universe, by the friend, to fall back into our being, to remember our soul, a newly skinned hide, bloody and gross. Our real self is out beyond ideas, in the wonder intimacy and ecstasy of our direct experience, devoid or cleansed of distinctions and differences. We are just the one knowing the one in the recognition of love of the one for itself. That's why Rumi says we should live as if we never heard these pronouns, you and I. There are no others. Resting as knowing of our direct experience in the unknown, something incredibly sacred takes hold, begins to move and have its way with us. It says, we are the night ocean filled with glints of light. We are the space between the fish and the moon while we sit here together. Thank you. So we have one more song here.